Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to Nothing Concrete, the Barbican's podcast. I'm Chris Gunness and this is The Art of Change, a series featuring artists who are passionate about changing the world. Today, the last in a four-part series featuring Stephen Fry, writer, actor, comedian and campaigner. Last time, Stephen talked about his public advocacy, taking on homophobes in Russia, Africa and Brazil, as well as flying the flag for men being honest about prostate cancer. Next, I asked about his own identity and the background to his attempts to change society.
I'm Jewish. My mother's still alive and she, you know, knew very well some of her family who didn't make it out of Europe. She comes from a family who's half in Austria and half in Hungary. What it was, Hungary, is now, in fact, Slovakia. And fortunately, my grandparents, her parents, came over to England, but their brothers and sisters and their cousins and so many who didn't make it to Israel or United States or to London and to Britain perished in the death camps. And the foundation of Israel was of fundamental importance to that part of my family, and I find I have to be very careful in not suggesting that I am encouraging those who seem to question the very validity of Israel as a state. And there is a problem with this ability to criticize Israel's monstrous policy within the country of establishing settlements that are just, you know, deeply wrong and against what the world has tried to express as the most likely shape for a possible two-state solution, and the Palestinian people who have been treated as worse than second-class citizens in so many cases. There's a division in trying to criticize that Israel and lending a voice to groups of people who also seem to use some of the anti-Semitic language of globalization and those bankers. And, you know, Jews have always been guilty both of creating capitalism with their banks and their Rothschilds and George Soros's and all the others that people use, and for creating communism and socialism in case of Marx and Trotsky and everything else. So, you know, we really are guilty, and we broke up the certainty of the world with Freud and Einstein. You know, everything Jews do is basically, you know, can be mocked and excoriated. And there's always been this kind of ontological problem with what is a Jew. And, you know, David Ben-Gurion, the founder of the State of Israel, the first leader of the country, when asked, are you religion or are you a race? What are you? I mean, there's Judaism, and is that what makes a Jew? Or is it? And he gave a typically Jewish and rather rabbinical answer. We are neither a race nor a religion. We are a people. Go figure. But that's kind of true, yeah. Because, you know, with an atheist like me, would as much be pushed into the death camps by the Nazis as a rabbi would. Mm. You know, they didn't care whether one. So in that sense, we're a race. If the Jewish heritage of scholarship and art and science and thinking and the primacy of the mind can't be brought to bear on solving the problem of Israel, it would be a terrible thing. Yeah. And so it is important for us Jews, I think, to have who are not Israelis who are voting in Israel about Israel, but those who are part of the diaspora around the world have a say in it. But yes, my mother's still alive, and I don't want to make her think that I'm siding with people who would try and destroy the Israel. And of course, I would suggest that all those critics of Israel are anti-Semitic and are determined to push Israel out. But it's not helped by the fact that two deeply corrupt leaders of the most important countries, when it comes to the solution, are so clearly regard Palestine as children who may or may not be given a few crumbs off the table.
And I just ask to whom you were referring?
Bibi Netanyahu and Mr. Trump.
Okay. See, I asked you a question, how strategic are you in this? When you approached the gay issue, when you approached the issue of bipolarity, it seemed to be such a natural form of advocacy. Mm. You simply talked about yourself and that instantly destigmatized. But were you strategic in the way you tried to destigmatize and try to make others understand?
I'm always strategic in the sense, or at least tactical. The strategy is to hope that everybody understands, but the tactics, the means of getting there, I'm not in advertising or PR, but I sometimes find myself thinking like someone in advertising and PR, and I do care about how a plea, a claim, a narrative will fall on the ears of those for whom the story is new. And as I say, bullying, hectoring, preaching, sermonizing is something I try not to do. It's very easy accidentally to sound like that. We all know how lovies can sound entitled and pleased with themselves and up themselves and all the rest of it. And so I try to think how an enemy of the cause or someone cynical or sceptical would respond and try to, and of course a lot of people hear that and say, oh, that Stephen's always trying to please everybody. and I know that that is a deep fault in me, but I do, I do try and be practical. I want to reach as many ears as possible and, in the jargon, give people permission to support whatever cause it is. And the easy way to give people permission is not to make them feel guilty. Mm. I do think that's always a mistake in charitable or any kind of cause advocacy is trying to wake up guilt in people. I think guilt usually leads to aggression and closing down and crossness. You really have to try, as I say, to allow people to realise that they're in a position to help. Mm. And it may not be by giving huge sums of money, but it may be a small amount of time. And in these days, it could just be by retweeting or helping in some other way. And I think that is definitely the answer.
The name of this podcast is The Art of Change. And I want to ask you about that. You have used comedy to change things very impressively. Do you think that art can also be used to change things?
It's an interesting question. We mentioned earlier Shelley describing poets as the unacknowledged legislators of the world, and this idea that has existed, that the highest doctrine of art as something that changes, has always appealed as a question. And I'm sure it's given in university exam questions, which changes the world first, science, philosophy, art, politics, history, war, disease, they're all, you can approach the way our species has changed and grown. You can take a big issue like racism, and you can say, is it Larry Ellison and the Invisible Man, novels like that about racism? Is it Maya Angelou? Is it early poets? Is it Harriet Beecher Stowe, the more kind, the white patriarchal kind of view of we mustn't enslave these nice people that we've treated so badly? Is it a mixture of those things? Is it people on the stump in the hustings? Is it a philosopher who suddenly allows you to think of humanity in a different way? It's hard to say that, you can look at particular moments, and Beethoven's a perfect example, straddling as he does these two periods of the end of, as it were, the age of reason and the opening of the Enlightenment and Romanticism. You can say, yes, there's no question that once energies like Beethoven were released in the world, who spoke to ordinary people, not just to princes, art began to be a force that changed. And then if you look at the beginning of the 20th century, was it Einstein showing the extraordinary difference in the nature of reality to what we'd assumed, the fractured nature of anything we believed stable, or was it Freud doing that to the human mind, showing that we weren't even in charge of ourselves, we had another self underneath us, like a god, only our own underneath us that was directing and commanding us? Or was it those early artists, the modernists, who suddenly, like Picasso, were painting images that were different, or Stravinsky and, Mahler sort of writing music, and, the end of Tristan, suddenly tonality and order and everything broke up. Now, did that come from a philosopher like Henri Bergson, who then influenced Proust and Joyce and the modernists, or was it that the modernists influenced the politicians? It's so hard to say. There seem to be times when balls of energetic thinking and rethinking and breaking down, and which is what analysis is, and then synthesizing new forces to make new statements and new thoughts about us. And then after the war, and the way young people and music and everything suddenly transformed the way everybody behaved and dressed and looked and talked to each other. These things happen, and art is always, if it's not the lead horse in that's pulling this extraordinary carriage along, it's one of them, and it's always involved in this movement.
And for you, but is there one art form, forget politics and philosophy, disease, etc., is there one art form you think which is most potent an agent of social change than any other?
That's really interesting, because I think in the past you could say it was poetry. Yeah, hard to believe, but I think it's true. I think poetry really did have an extraordinary... Well, certainly in our culture. I mean, obviously this can't be true all over the world.
How long ago was that, incidentally?
Well, I think it was around the time between lyrical ballads in the end of the 18th century, and then the rise of the Romantics, through to Browning and characters like that, and then with the modernists as well. They I think, really did change people's minds about things. They did what Elvis and the Beatles did for others. They broke the mold of social norms and made people think in new ways and new patterns, and they reinvented the way of thinking and it's top down. I mean, it's like Formula One. None of us is going to drive a Formula One car, but I can remember when things like ABS braking were considered incredibly new. They came from Formula One, and then they arrived in every single car. Now you don't even have to know what it is. It's just a system that controls the way you brake and make sure you don't slide so much. And all these extraordinarily expensive elitist things at the top filter down. And I'm not saying this is a way to stop being angry about the elitism of the world, but art is special, and it does affect. Now, I would wonder if it's music. I mean, it's certainly hip-hop and so on. It inflames, in a good sense, the consciousness and the spirit of young people, and that's the key, because my day's over. We are over in that way. We can say a few things, but...
Comedy,
yes. I mean... Somebody said, and this was about 20 years ago, that comedy had taken over as unacknowledged legislators of the world. I mean, I would rather read Stuart Lee or Frankie Boyle now, in terms of politics and society, than the most cultural commentators, to be honest. I mean, I think they absolutely nail things in the way that Bill Hicks did earlier, and that's new, and if I genuinely believe that, I think if I want to hear something really absolutely on the money about Brexit or some other big issue at the moment, or Boris or whatever it might be, I'd far rather read Frankie Boyle on the subject.
Wow.
He seems to me to penetrate the truths about it, and in his being funny, he's releasing a whole series of truths, because you can't really laugh at something that isn't true. I mean, you can laugh at surreality, but even surreality has the word reality in it. That's the point.
If your causes have chosen you.
Mm.
What do you think are going to be the next causes that you're going to dedicate yourself to? You mentioned Boris. Would it be politics? Would it be something else?
Well, I always say, to wind up climate change denialists, I say, well, this is something I, like you, I just don't give a fig about it. I don't care at all, because, like you, because in my case, it's because I don't have children. So I don't care about, because if I had children, obviously, they would be inheriting a world in which they would suffer in ways that I have never suffered and you've never suffered. You, of course, don't give a shit. I don't know why, but you don't. And I'm like you. And they go, no, come on. And that's, I'm not, saying, no, truly, you obviously don't give a shit, because if you've got children, you would give a shit. And obviously I do give a shit because I have got children and lots of them and nephews and now a great nephew, I have to say. It's hard to dodge that particular tsunami that is heading our way, both literal and metaphoric probably. It is... All other issues seem to pale next to it, because how can you prepare for a world of greater social justice, greater ease of living if such a horror is coming?
Stephen Fry, many thanks for being my guest.
It's a real pleasure.
Really, it's a pleasure to meet you. Thank you so much, Stephen.
Thank you.
That was Stephen Fry, ending this episode of The Art of Change on Nothing Concrete with me, Chris Gunness. It brings to an end this four-part series with Stephen Fry. You can subscribe to Nothing Concrete on Acast, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. And if you can, leave us a review to help get the word out. Until next time, from me, Chris Gunness, goodbye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.